Welcome back to the margins of Riga Strachan Dialogue 2022. Today we're joined by Nika Alexeyeva, who is the lead researcher for the Baltics at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab based in Latvia. Nika, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Nika, your presence on this podcast today, it's a breath of fresh air. I think we're all a bit tired of geopolitical discussions or these very existential philosophical dilemmas. I think today I would like to take the opportunity to draw on your kind of practical expertise in cybersecurity. And I think that we would benefit from discussing some of the kind of practical considerations and adjustments that each of us can make to protect ourselves better as we navigate the digital environment every single day. You know, the ongoing Russia's war against Ukraine has maybe reawakened concerns about the uncontrolled spread of this information. You know, I have even friends sort of sending me images or videos allegedly from the war whose authenticity is very difficult to verify. And maybe we could begin with a bit of a broader question, kind of what are some of the trends in the information space that you are seeing amidst the conflict? What are some of the worrying dynamics that we should look out for?
Sure. So if we talk in broad terms, wartime versus peacetime or alleged peacetime before, then if we compare what information space was about during the peacetime, we could see more like long-term investments in, say, Kremlin media starting launching their activities in many countries, doing various information operations, probably also ghostwriter and others that were more kind of labor intensive, probably more thought through. But now during wartime, which eventually war everyone took by surprise. Ukrainians, of course, because though they were warned, no one truly believed that invasion will be such a full scale. But also in Russia, there are many signals from within Russia that's mediated by independent journalists who are now in exile, but still have access to, say, Kremlin close people in the circles within the Kremlin, who are also confirming that there's chaos. War took Kremlin, a larger apparatus, also unprepared. And now that there's a fire on the ground, physical, kinetic war, of course, there are also fire battles taking place in information space. And at first, of course, everyone took attention to what's happening on the ground. Basically, many videos started to circulate. And at that point, when many things are developing rapidly and there are many digital materials out there, of course, it's a very nice situation to just throw in some unverified video, probably taken from another place, another time. We call it miscontextualized content, to allege that, we'll see what's happening now in Ukraine, though it happened 5 years in, say, Palestine, right? Yeah. So that was the first trend. And of course, there was a lot of information fog. Things were developing super, super quickly. Everyone wanted to be first. And of course, we know that there's always a dilemma, like if you want to be first or do you really want to be right about what you say? So, of course, like now, not all outlets that are out there in the internet follow the same rules of quality journalism. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if you just monitor information space, there was a lot of rumors, a lot of unconfirmed facts or facts based on, say, now with anonymous sources, it's kind of more justifiable to not disclose true identities of people. But still, the level of certainty about things should have been and was questioned quite a lot. Now, the first effect of the surprise is kind of gone. And we also see that there are less developments or developments, they are kind of more predictable. Everyone's already acknowledged that it's hot war situation and we are living in this reality for 3 months already. Nevertheless, if we look at Russia's disinformation activities, they are still largely directed at their domestic audiences. Well, at first, and we saw it in social media data, the most trending hashtag on across social media was no to war, нет войне. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing that trended. And of course, like in response, other pro-Kremlin hashtags, мне не стыдно, I'm not ashamed, because many said that they are ashamed to be Russians or part of the country. These alternative hashtags also appeared. But if you compare how much they trended, нет войне, no to war, trended much, much, much more. So many celebrities went out, very outspoken, condemned the war. And now we see that, well, due to a very controlled information space in Russia, controlled via conventional media, but also mm-hmm. social media. ВКонтакте is directly controlled by president's administration, as we know it. Well, people were, and also the persecutions of protesters who protested against the war, all it kind of made people less outspoken, and probably in public polls that come from Russia, of course, there's always this level of how much can we trust this data. They kind of came out. So that is the effect of disinformation campaign, or rather propaganda and campaign to convince people why war is justifiable, directed at the local audiences. Nevertheless, of course, there was a spillover effect due to language. Russians in other countries, neighboring countries, including the Baltics, in the Baltic states, we have Russian population, of course, they can, even now that many sites are banned, they still have access to information coming from propaganda channels that are also explaining why Russia has the right to attack Ukraine.
So how do they have this access? How do they get it?
Yeah, so one way is through VPN, virtual servers that you connect, and it looks that you are connecting from other place where, say, RT, Sputnik are not banned. Another way is through Telegram. Telegram is another battleground because the content moderation policies are super weak there. Basically, almost any content is allowed there. Of course, there's a way to report, but anyhow, like, it's the place where you will find Russian propaganda and Ukrainian wartime communication efforts. Well, what's propaganda is another.
But is this a new development? Because Telegram used to have the reputation of this kind of independent entity, that this would be where you could communicate actually more safely if you wanted to prevent your communications from being monitored by, let's say, Russian intelligence services or government bodies.
Mm-hmm. It's not surprised that Telegram plays this role in the war, but it's new that Russian propaganda creates so many accounts and is scouting Telegram for also, say, intelligence information on the ground, and that also Telegram is now the place for Ukrainian regular internet users to gather information from. I mean, these countries, they had their presence on Telegram, but not in confronting manner. That is new, that now that's the battleground, because you can't have the same on VK, which is more restricted abroad and kind of the social media network for Russians, probably among Russians, including Odnoklassniki as well. And like Meta's products, as Instagram, Facebook, are also banned. Twitter is banned. It doesn't mean that there are no people from Russia who are posting there using, again, other like circumvention methods to do that. And probably there are also troll farms still present and operating. Nevertheless, these are not spaces where you can go and get both countries, like see how they are fighting, how exchange of information is happening. And additional challenge for researchers is that Telegram is not transparent. Currently, there is no good data source for mm-hmm. Telegram. You need to scrape it. And when you scrape channels, you need to make a list of them, which will also be a sample. So you don't get this bird view analysis.
So it's very difficult to analyze on a wider scale.
Exactly. You're always working with some sample and trying to draw conclusions. And also, you can analyze spread, but it's not as evident as on other platforms that we Western platforms that are more transparent in that regard.
Thank you very much for this introduction. I think it would maybe be helpful to narrow down a bit to look at the individual level. And when it comes to looking at sort of vulnerabilities that we have or means through which we are manipulated in the digital environment, we can distinguish between kind of cyber means of manipulation and cognitive means. Would you perhaps be able to explain a bit to our audience this distinction and the practical steps and initiatives that we can take to protect ourselves better in both of those dimensions?
Sure. So cyber dimension is really bound to how internet works. What are the systems behind how information flows between sites, between various platforms, assets, and so on? Like, it also really depends on your device. What rights do you give to platforms or apps to use your device to access, say, a camera or microphone and things like that? So that's the cyberspace. While cognitive space is basically you. That's your perception, probably also some consciousness. Well, I mean, like, cognition is still when you are awake, but of course it influences your unconsciousness, mm-hmm. and then you make decisions based on that. So that's the kind of difference between cyber and cognitive aspect. And they are both related, though in different ways. So on cyber, you need to be vigilant. When someone reaches out to you, unknown person, and prompts you to open a link, for instance, because the link may contain a virus that will infect your device, and the attacker probably can get access to your device and control on your behalf. Mm-hmm. Compromised devices means that, well, you are not in control. Someone else can take over your social media accounts and then start posting things, because we don't know, they could be both right, wrong, just opinions or facts on your behalf. There's very kind of widespread idea that, well, I'm just a regular person. Who would want to hack me? Yeah. Like, why am I
think this is something my
relevant?
Mother always says when I tell her to change passwords. She's always like, nobody needs my information, you know? It's not worth anything.
And such reaction is there because when you are doing your cyber hygiene, it means changing some behavior and sacrificing a bit of comfort, because it's super comfortable when all your passwords are kind of already like filled on your behalf through various password administration apps, though it's not that they are totally insecure. It's just that you need to understand what's secure about them and what's not. Okay. So, yeah, you need to sacrifice your comfort, and then you look for justifications. And mm-hmm. I'm not important. Why should I bother? But even if you are not some public facing figure, let's say someone takes your account, and for other users who see what new you is posting now, you will look like very, say, trustworthy. Like when you are posting things to your friends, they would have this habit of always trusting you. So they will trust whatever you say at first. For outsiders, let's say you're posting publicly, so anyone can read your message and see that you are driving engagement. They may think that these are really your thoughts, that you are an authentic user, though actually there's, well, let's imagine like Kremlin troll controlling your account, and you become the troll. Your identity is being hijacked.
So for a hostile actor, this would be a shortcut, because, you know, it would take time to create a fake account and kind of build it up so it would have this kind of credibility and trust in order to drive engagement, to build up its, I don't know, network of friends and build up all of this activity to give it a track record of having authentic behavior. In this case, it would be far easier to take your account with your, you know, hundreds of real friends and followers and so on, and exploit it for such purposes.
Exactly. Moreover, platforms made it more difficult to create those false accounts. Well, there are more steps implemented that make you to use unique phone number or sometimes even identify yourself if you want to create an account, which of course attracts the idea that, hey, maybe it's better to hack someone. And it really, so again, coming back to the cyber hygiene, it's really like up to a person and awareness, because if you are just clicking next without really kind of thinking about what you are allowing, apps that you just, I don't know, fun apps, face swap for instance, or something else, how to use device, then, well, app stores, they do provide some level of verification of if app is safe or not, But on the other hand, it's still people who are verifying apps. And it's really up to processes that are implemented to verify if you can trust the app or not. Two-factor authentication, as simple as that. Mm-hmm. If you have just your password, let's say it's like super difficult or, well, whatever, but it consists of five characters. It takes very small time for a computer to actually run all combinations of, say, all letters, signs, and digits to actually crack your password. Because it's not that someone is trying to guess your password. It's really kind of systematic approach by a computer to run various combinations. And the longer your password, the more secure it is, because it takes more time for a computer to actually finally kind of get to the right combination. So let's say this first level is cracked. Next level, and that's two-factor authentication, because it's the second one, is that you get message or the app prompts you to submit some mm-hmm. code. And it's really connected to your device that's physically in your pocket. So even if you're hacked from overseas, someone's trying to get into your account, you will get notification. First thing you need to do is to say that it wasn't you who tried to log in. So there is also signal to the platform that some hacking attempt is taking place. And then basically, just go through your passwords. Don't use the same password across other platforms, because if they guessed one, they will use the same. Well, because people are lazy and that's what people do. They will try it with other popular platforms. And so you will not lose, say, Facebook account, but also your Twitter, LinkedIn, and so on. And it will look very authentic for a researcher that all of a sudden you start posting things and they are consistently malign throughout all platforms. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, overnight you became the troll. And it's hard for me to prove that you are not a real person, because it's like, your identity looks quite organic.
But to follow up on this in a bit of a maybe provoking way, so what would you say is the easiest way to hack a Facebook account? Is the conventional way really to use these kind of advanced computers that try to crack the codes? Or is it more that because people use the same passwords, there are often these like data leaks on some app, and then you kind of would try to use the data acquired on via those leaks and apply it vis-a-vis different platforms. Sort of, if you wanted to hack into my Facebook account, how would you go about this?
Well, full disclosure, at the beginning of podcast, you said that I have expertise in cyber domain. Actually, I have expertise in open source intelligence, which in my case does not mean cyberspace necessarily. So I'm not a white hacker. I can't really tell which method is best, but you just basically describe two methods that are available.
So when it comes to manipulation on online platforms, most of the attention, I think rightfully so, is on these Western big tech platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Google, so on. But what is the situation like on less popular platforms? So you already alluded to ВКонтакте, but in Latvia, for example, we have a platform that used to be very popular, but now has lost its market share, Draugiem. And I'm sure that in most countries, there are also these less popular platforms. What are the consequences of maybe these platforms existing with less oversight, less moderation? What sort of concerns does that raise?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the tendency that also big tech platforms see when it comes to foreign influence operations, say again, from the Internet Research Agency or other troll farms. They shifted from big platforms creating sock puppet accounts there to fringe platforms. Exactly. As you mentioned, content moderation is very limited there due to human resources or technical capabilities, again, connected with human resources. And that's the place where also kind of fringes of society are hanging out. They are usually quite industry specific or topic or country specific, or I don't know, some other social economic characteristic specific. In terms of, say, abundant social media platforms, as in Latvia's case, Draugiem LV, there are other countries with their personal social media accounts that are now, well, basically that lost their traction because all people went to, say, Twitter, Facebook. basically people started to using it probably at the time when we started to learn what social media is as a thing. And so people experimented a little bit, you know, like posted photos. Like now it's fine on TikTok to do silly stuff and get engagement. Well, at that point, people did silly stuff. It was left there. It wasn't kind of that intentional. And people did not think that someone will ever use that data about them. And well, one use case, of course, could be that someone wants to not really blackmail you, because this information is public, but more like, well, blackmail that they will ruin your
like
reputation.
Extort something from you.
Yeah. Exactly, from your past. Let's say when you were a teenager, you were using Draugi.lv, but now you are a grown-up, you have your career, but then there is the silly picture of, say, pencils in your nostrils or something like, you know, and say you're running for elections or there are other reputational risks that you may encounter. And yeah, there could be kind of smearing campaign using this image of silly you, creating memes. Like memes are a very powerful cognitive tool that may influence like larger societies. So yeah, it's best if you just go back in time and remember where you signed up, check what content is there. Shortcut could be just Googling yourself. Google yourself and use a search operator, like look in particular site. For Latvia, like site draugiem.lv, your name, surname, and see what pops up. Because probably that's also the gateway for people to search you online. Yeah. There are also ways to set up Google Alerts, and you will get email notification
if something about you pops up.
So yeah, it's good to basically Google yourself time to time and see what others can see about you.
Maybe in the kind of concluding phase of the conversation, you know, words like digital literacy are now kind of buzzwords, you know, or kind of focus on education when it comes to cybersecurity and so on. And I think the conventional focus on these subjects is on the youth, right? Because the young people spend, you know, the vast majority of their lives online or interacting with the digital world in some way. But often overlooked are vulnerabilities among other demographic groups in society or even other generations. You know, the studies show that, in fact, it's often older people who fall victim to all sorts of phishing scams or financial fraud scams or so on. Could you maybe discuss what sort of investments we as societies need to make to mitigate these vulnerabilities and maybe what other trends you see in this sense?
Yeah, you're completely right. The older generation is quite overlooked in media literacy campaigns because, of course, it's easier to advocate, oh, we need to have media literacy embedded in our education system because system already exists. How do you reach people who are already kind of old enough to be your father or maybe even grandparents? How do you talk with them from a position of like a young adult or say adult in your 40s? Like how do you talk with people who are actually pushed into digital engagement spaces during COVID times, because that was the only way they can basically know and get updates about the life of their relatives, granddaughter or a daughter or whoever, because they can't meet physically in person due to COVID. And so it's like steering a car on a driveway without having a license. You know, you are just there, you are surfing internet space, things come your way, you click on hyperlinks, you see a content of a person you know, so you will always like or you will write a comment. Probably you wouldn't think that someone else is reading your comments and things like that. Yeah. So it's very important. Plus now, like social media exists since say mid or first half of 2000s, early 2000s. So before it was mostly print or say there were conventional media outlets online, but mostly, yeah, they were like copies of the printed version.
Yep.
And people of older generation, they have the habit, if you have print, I mean like machine, printed it. It means that you have resources. It means that you got this printing machine because you're having this media enterprise, which means that you also have a staff, journalists who are writing. You have editor who checked the content. So when you get this printed word, there was some due diligence done on your behalf. Now, on the web, all text is print. It looks like print, though like it could be just one person who is sharing his or her opinion presented as fact, and there is no filter. And these people weren't trained to do any information filtering. Okay, we can also compare people coming from, say, Soviet Union, where information exchange was much different from, say, Western countries, mm-hmm. who developed and printed word media, the fourth estate, which facilitates public debate. Like, it's different. But now it's kind of all online. Plus, there are no geographical boundaries between countries. It's only language, and even language is erased because you can use automatic translations. Of course, we can debate about their quality, but still you can get content from, say, India, very kind of marginal group, or I don't know, also that's how radical extremists emerge in, say, Latvian countryside, because they have access without any geographical boundaries. And there is this kind of cognitive trust in printed word. And of course, like also with age, psychologists can explain it better, but our cognition is also like very developed. We have a lot of experience, which means that we also have a lot of shortcuts of how we process information or new ideas or events that are happening. And it's much different from how young people use information, process it, and add it to their still developing brain. Let's put it this way. So yeah, we are lacking this quite targeted educational campaign directed at older generation.
Well, as they say, whether we like it or not, each of us is a participant in information warfare and in the digital world. So this is certainly a challenge that all generations will continue to grapple with. Nika, thank you so much for joining us, for really giving some tangible advice. I think it was immensely useful. Thank you.
Thank you.